Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and licenses and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA and the EPA or the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what you're not supposed to know about private business. Now, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Call us at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our webpage and go to our archives page on our website, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. All right, we're talking about the simplicity of economics. It seems like, it sounds like, and when we listen to economists, that it is an impenetrable subject of boredom and difficulties, and I just can't make heads or tails out of it. The simplicity of it is fairly simple. There's no free lunch, and you can't get something for nothing. And as soon as somebody is telling you that you can get something for nothing or there's a free lunch, you know he's lying to you. Just that simple. No fuss, no muss. Now, all wealth comes out of the ground. We showed you that mining, fishing, farming, and forestry are the four areas where all wealth comes out of the ground, and that human beings are imbued with five motivators: vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And the best way to harness vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear is with a free market economy. 300 million Americans making their own purchases free from any coercion whatsoever. It was what we would call a free market economy, and it would be far different than what we're spending our money on today. I would venture a guess and say that most Americans did not want to spend a lot of money bailing out Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan. But your political representatives decided that that's what you wanted to spend your money on. And so they went out and spent your money, and you're going to have to pay that bill. My guess is that if instead of giving $750 billion to these Wall Street banks, that they, if the government had just left that $750 billion in your pocket, you would have gone out and spent that $750 billion on the things that you wanted. It's true. Goldman Sachs would have gone bankrupt, and J.P. Morgan and AIG and the rest of them, they would have all gone upside down. That's what happened in 1783. The economy collapsed, and within about 5 or 6 years, it revived itself in what, under our Constitution, at Article 1, Section 10, using just weights and balances, it revived itself in about 36 months. 36 months. And George Washington wrote a letter to a cohort, and he marveled at the rapidity with which the economy had revived itself from 1787 to 1790. He said he couldn't believe that the economy could recover so expeditiously. But that's the miracle of the free marketplace. Wherever it's been tried in the past, it has produced marvelous results, and we see that in the United States of America between about 1800 and 1950. Remarkable results with the free marketplace. But when government got involved in the economy in 1933, things started to go haywire. And now, 80 years later, we take a look and the thing is in total collapse. Not just in the United States, but around the world. Socialism, every place it's been tried in the world, has always failed, has never succeeded. There's not one historical example of a socialist scheme that has succeeded. And on the other hand, there isn't a single example of a free market economy that has failed. It has always brought about spectacular results. It has always built gigantic world-ruling empires, like Rome, Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, Great Britain, the United States, every time it's been used. That's why I'm a proponent of this free market economy, and I subscribe to the Austrian theory of economics. If the government just leaves people alone, and I showed you in the last program, when government got involved in my business, I woke up one day and said, you know, I've had enough of this, and I closed it down. And that's what businessmen do. When they get enough, they leave. People are leaving California, businessmen, business people, because they've had enough. They just got up and left. I did. I left California and went to Idaho. Then when I got enough of the bureaucracy in Idaho, I said, you know, enough's enough, and I quit again. And I told you that I'm happy to report that now I employ no one, produce nothing, and pay no tax. Now, that's the exact opposite from what government really wants. Government wants us to work hard, produce a bunch, and pay a lot of taxes to support a lot of parasites. So I pointed out to you that if you're not engaged in mining, fishing, farming, or forestry, then you're engaged in an active parasite. Parasite. A dog can live forever without a tick, but no tick can live without a dog. Parasites must have a host. And that's why politicians, bankers, insurance agents, these peripheral industries and agencies that we have been taught and trained from the time we're little children that we cannot live without. You cannot live without a bank. You cannot live without an insurance company. You can't live without voting. And I'm sitting here saying, well, what is it that the insurance company, the bank, or the ballot box has ever put into your pocket? Name one. Now, it is true that the parasites live well off of the hosts. And that's why the parasites are constantly telling us that we need national health care insurance, we need OSHA, the EPA, we need labor unions. We need all of these things that the parasites use to suck the blood out of the mining, fishing, farming, and forestry producers. The real producers in the economy have to feed the parasites. If we had an economy without any mining, fishing, farming, or forestry, all we had was, if all we had as industry in America was a service industry like insurance and banking, and everybody in the country was a lawyer, a banker, a preacher, or an insurance salesman, what do you think would happen? We would all starve to death. None of those people produce anything to eat. They don't produce any automobiles. They produce nothing and consume much. Now, it is true that we do need a few policemen and a fireman or two, and there are some politicians that we could probably tolerate, but the thing is so far out of balance, and I pointed this out, is, you know, when it gets out of balance and 51% of the people in the country have turned to becoming parasites and 49% are the producers, I don't know where the breakover point's going to come, but at some point in time, there simply will not be enough for the rest of us to eat. There will come a time when you won't have enough there to eat. And long before you get to that point, the system is going to fail. It's going to fall on its face. Now, we're listening to a fetish of full employment. So let's talk about employment, because the president's constantly telling us, I'm not going to rest until every American that wants a job is working. I'm not looking for a job. I don't want any employment. There's no money in it. What I want is property. What I want is production. I want to get into mining, fishing, farming, and forestry right up to my elbows, and I want to produce, and then I want to keep what I produce. I know that's a wild new idea. Now, what we're doing here is we're going out and we're working, getting a paycheck, and we're taking the paycheck, putting it in the bank. Other people come along and they take portions of it. For instance, you signed a deal. You went to work for your employer for $10 an hour. You're working 40 hours a week. You should get $400 a week. You're not getting $400 a week. You're getting $310. So what's happening to that $90 a week? Well, that's going to the parasites. And then somebody says, you got to have auto insurance on your car, more parasites. Then you've got OSHA and EPA inspectors and state tax collectors and this guy and that guy coming along. This is why in our Constitution, Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence pointed out that we had a group of people who were eating out our substance. These government agents and agencies are eating out our substance. Now, the substance is the stuff that we produce, the houses and automobiles and washing machines and refrigerators and carpet, you know, all those things that we want to buy, all those things that we want to consume, those things that mean something to us. Now, the government wants to go out, and in Detroit, I was watching PBS the other night, and they're going to, the socialist planners, God, these guys are dreamers. Now, Detroit, you want to remember, was built from about 1800 to about 1950 or 60. It reached its peak, its zenith, about 1960, and then began to decline. And today it's a mere shell of what it was. About half the people have moved out. 40% of the city has been torn down. It's 139 square miles, and 40% of it is just vacant lots. How much is that? 139 times 0.40. 55 square miles of it is just vacant lots. In fact, they're taking that 55 square miles, that's 55.6 sections, times 640 acres, and they're turning it into urban farming. That's 35,500 acres. 35,000 acres. And they're going to turn that into farming. They're farming in Detroit now because they can make more money, I guess, growing corn and wheat than they can and getting taxes off of the people that aren't paying the taxes on all the property there. Well, anyway, they said they want to build a light rail system. They're going to take the taxpayers' money. They don't have enough public transportation in the city. And so the dreamers said, we'll build a light rail system down Woodward Boulevard for 3.5 miles. I don't know how much money that's going to take, but they said it'll produce employment. And it will. And it'll produce brand new streetcars and tracks. You'll be able to see the tracks in the street. But when it's all said and done, and the money is spent, that'll be the end of it. And as I pointed out last time, if you spent the same amount of money in farming, it would multiply itself times 7. For every dollar you spend, it multiplies times 7. Now, from 1800 to 1950, without any Social Security, without any light rail, without any government programs, without any pump priming, Detroit became the world transportation capital in 150 years. From just nothing, you know, just a couple of wagon tracks in the dirt in 1800 until 1950 became the world's hub, transportation hub. Today it's just a ghetto. From what I saw on TV, there's just not much there, and what's there is disintegrating. And so the moral to the story here is that there's something wrong with the economic system that we've been following. There was nothing wrong with the economic system that we followed from 1800 to 1950, but something that we've been doing since 1950 to 2010 has caused Detroit to disintegrate. And boys and girls, it's not just Detroit, it's St. Louis, Kansas City, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, anywhere you look in America, these great cities are disintegrating in front of your eyeballs. What's causing that? What did it? Well, let's take a look at this thing of employment. The economic goal of any nation, as of any individual, is to get the greatest results with the least effort. We want to get as much as we can, and we want to pay just as little as possible to get it. That's what the whole game is all about. The whole economic progress of mankind has consisted in getting more production with the same labor. And it's for this reason that men began putting burdens on the backs of donkeys instead of on their own backs, that they went on to invent the wheel and the wagon, the railroad and the motor truck. It's for this very reason that men have used their ingenuity to develop 100,000 labor-saving inventions. If there's anything that I can do that will get my job done faster and easier, that's the way I want to employ it. Don't you? Isn't that what everybody does? Ladies, don't you have a dishwasher in your house so that you can have the dishwasher wash your dishes instead of you spending 2 or 3 hours a day washing dishes at the sink? Didn't you go out and buy that dishwasher and have it installed so that you could flip the button, wash the dishes, and then you can spend your time doing something else? Isn't that why you have an automatic washer and dryer, ladies? Is so that instead of washing these clothes down on the river by pounding them on rocks, that you could throw them into the machine would wash the clothes, you can take them out of that machine, stick them in the other machine and dry them so that you could be productively spending your time doing something else. I mean, come on, kids, that's the name of the game. Well, if that is so good for you personally, or if it's so good for your family in your home, well then, doesn't it make sense then that that would be good for the whole nation? It's what we call productivity. Now, all this is so elementary that one would blush to state it if it were not being so constantly forgotten by those who coin and circulate all these new slogans. Translated into national terms, this first principle means that our real objective is to maximize production, and in doing this, full employment, that is, the absence of any involuntary idleness, becomes a necessary byproduct. But production is the end. Employment is the means, and we cannot continuously have the fullest production without full employment. But we can easily have full employment without full production. So every time that the government or a government agent speaks up, he says, "We got to have full employment. We got to get after this unemployment. We got to just work our hearts out here to give everybody a job." I'm sitting here saying, what for? Hell, the last thing in the world I want is employment. The first thing I want is production. Production. That's where the wealth is. You know, boys and girls, if we wanted to have full employment, we could go back to 1900. My granddad told me a story. I got to tell you, it sounds kind of wild and weird, but in 1900, a day's wage was $1. He had a dollar a day. And my granddad worked from 6 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night, a 12-hour work day, 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. And he carried ties. He was a tie carrier. And from the shore, he worked at the Union Lumber Company, and they had a landing down there, and they loaded the ship. See, this is before they had Highway 101, before they had the railroad. And all of the lumber that was being produced there in Fort Bragg, California, was loaded on ships. And there was no big port there, so they had a long pier that went out into the ocean, and then the ship would be out there at the end of this pier. It was a quarter of a mile long. And so they had machinery to bring the ties down to the dock, but to get it from the dock out to the ship, you had to carry a tie on your shoulder. So here's maybe 100 men, and they're getting paid $1 a day. And they would walk a quarter of a mile out with a tie, drop it off, and then come back. Now, at the end of the day, I imagine my granddad probably made 12, 14, maybe 16 trips a day, maybe. And he might have loaded 10, 12, 14, 16 ties on that ship. And then maybe you got 100 guys carrying 12 ties. That's 1,200 ties are moved out to that ship and loaded on the ship. Now, that's full employment. Those guys are sweating. They're working hard. They're just doing their best. All right. Now, today we would laugh at that kind of nonsense. Today, that ship pulls up to the dock, and they have machinery that picks up whole truckloads of ties and loads the whole truckload, loads the whole container right onto the ship. Now, those are labor-saving devices. Now, if we wanted to go back to full employment, why don't we destroy all the machinery, get rid of all of the steamships, and go back to sailing ships? It takes more sailors to sail a sailing ship. It takes more longshoremen to load a ship by hand than it does to load it with machinery. Do you think that that would increase the standard of living of Americans if we did that? Do you think my granddad in 1900 was living better than we're living today, with all of the machinery that we have? Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, the trick in life is to get the most production possible with the least effort that we can exert. That's the objective. That's called productivity. And the reason that we keep inventing these machines, the reason that we put dishwashers in our homes instead of washing dishes by hand, and the reason that we put washing machines in our home instead of going down to the riverbank and beating them on a rock, is so that we can increase our productivity, so that we can live better. We can have a higher standard of living. It's not employment that gives you the higher standard of living, children. It is production. We want to produce more bales of hay. We want to get more tons per acre, more bushels per acre. I can remember when wheat, 30 bushels an acre, was a big deal. Now it's common to get 100 bushels to the acre. I saw in a report the other day, corn, 160 bushels to the acre. 130 is pretty common. Hell, when I was a kid, if you got 60 bushels to the acre, man, you were doing top 400 material there. So by increasing our production, by using labor-saving devices, by using machinery instead of our backs, we're able to produce more. And then when we produce more, we live better. Now let's go back and tell you a little story here. In 1790 in England, there were sock knitters. These are people who made socks. And according to the official records, there were about 7,000 sock knitters in Great Britain, or in England, in 1790. Now, not very many people in England wore socks. Only the aristocrats, only people with money wore socks. And that's because socks were very expensive. You were paying to have somebody sit down and knit a pair of socks. Now, somebody looked at that, and I don't know who this guy was, but somebody looked at that, and they invented a machine that would knit these socks. And when they did that, they started employing these machines. And as they employed the machines, it knocked the sock knitters out of employment. Just like the opening of the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge knocked out all of the ferry owners and all of the people that worked on the docks, you know, loading all those people and hauling them across the bay. They all lost their jobs. And boy, it just caused a hell of a ruckus. And so the knitters, they went on strike. They got mad and they started breaking things and breaking windows, and took a little time to restore order. Now, by 1820, now look at 1790 to 1820, 30 years. In that 30-year period, a revolution occurred in the sock industry in Great Britain. By 1830, the number of people working producing socks with machines was 40,000. 40,000. Now remember, the total number of people making socks in 1790 was 7,000. Now, armed with machines, there's 40,000. And they're making a hell of an export business. Now, furthermore, in the same 30-year period, the common people of England, everybody by 1830 was wearing socks. I have never spent a day of my life without socks. I loathe going around without socks. When I slip on a pair of shoes and I don't have socks on that's rough on my feet, I hate it. I always put on socks. I don't know what it would be like to live life without socks. In 1790, the average Englishman did not know what it was like to live with socks. Now, far from machinery throwing people out of work, what it did was it expanded the marketplace from a few thousand aristocrats who could afford hand-knitted socks to the entire population of the country now wearing socks. Instead of 10,000 people wearing socks, now 10 million people wear socks. Instead of 7,000 people making socks for 10,000 aristocrats, now all of a sudden we've got 40,000 people making millions of pairs of socks for millions of people, and for a whole lot less money. Now the aristocrats, instead of spending $25 or $30 for a pair of socks, are paying $2 for a pair of socks. Well, for $2, nearly everybody can afford a pair of socks. Now that's what productivity does. Productivity is what makes your standard of living. Now our government bureaucrats come along and they tell us, they believe, they write books, that there's a finite amount of labor out there. There's a finite amount of work to do, and we've got to match up these two finite numbers, and we've got to spread this work around. What a crock of baloney. Talk about a fallacy. Now, I live on a farm, and I can tell you right now, there is no shortage of work here. I have work that I have wanted to do here for 20 years, and I just never got around to it yet. There's things that I would like to do, fences I would like to build, roads I would like to do. There are trees I would like to cut. There's thinning of the forest that I would like to do. There's farming that I'd like to accomplish. I don't have time for that. I have to do what has to be done first, and then if I have any time left over, I go on to the next project and the next project and so on. Now, we have to decide what's going to pay us the most return. Now, in Detroit, the people are crying up there. They say, we've got to have more public transportation. Listen, the reason that your public transportation system has disintegrated in front of your eyeballs is because you adopted socialist policies. The socialist policies have come to their conclusion. And now, it costs more money to run your public transportation system than it can make, than it can earn. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose you got a bus. And this bus has a driver, and it costs you $100 a day to pay the driver. And it costs you $100 a day for fuel and operating expenses. And it costs you $100 a day to amortize the price of the bus, which costs you, you know, maybe $100,000. So you've got to make $300 a day operating this bus 24 hours a day, three drivers, 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, running up and down this particular route. And it's got to haul at least 300 passengers paying $1 a day just to cover its expenses. Now let's suppose that in a day's time it hauls 290 passengers, That's 290 days. It costs $300 to operate the equipment, pay the driver, and pay for the upkeep, but it only draws in $290. Now listen, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar. You don't have to be an expert in math to figure out that that won't work forever. Now on the other hand, if you had a bus and you were spending $300 a day, and you had 600 passengers a day operating the bus, or using the bus, you'd be making $300 a day profit. Don't you think after a while you'd have competition and other people would be out there offering bus service for 50 cents instead of a dollar? I mean, you know, if you had a free market economy. Now, what we do is we give this franchise to the city. We don't allow any competition. Now, transportation is a fundamental of life. We all like transportation. So let me give you a quick illustration here. Up in Idaho, there was a guy by the name of Glenn. I don't know if that was his last name or his first name, but it's at a place that's now called Glenn's Ferry, Idaho. And it's on the Snake River. And this guy, Glenn, opened up a ferry service. You see, they had all these wagon trains coming from the east, and they were on their way to Oregon and California, and they used the Oregon Trail. And so he observed that when the wagons got to the Snake River, it was a big, broad river, they'd have to stop and spend a day to cut down trees and build a raft. And then they would have to float that raft back and forth across the river. And then when it was all said and done, it would take them about 3 or 4 days to get the wagon train across, and then they'd go on about their business. And he got to thinking about that, so he built a raft, and he stretched a long cable across the river. And then he tied his raft to the cable so that it wouldn't be swept downstream. And then he could push the raft along the cable, which was attached to the raft, from one side to the other. And he charged people a dollar to take them across. Now, a wagon train pulls up, and you've got a choice. This is the marketplace at work. You can stop, you can build your own raft, and you can go across the river, or you can pay Mr. Glenn a dollar each for the 50 or 75 wagons in your train, and he'll make 50 or 75 bucks. Well, if there was 20, 30, 40 wagon trains a year, you know, Mr. Glenn would make a few hundred bucks a year. Pretty soon, Mr. Glenn built a hotel and then a restaurant, and then he put in a livery stable, and now there's a town called Glenn's Ferry, Idaho. That's what the free marketplace is all about. If the people want to pay a buck to use his ferry, they will. If they want to build their own raft, they can do that too. But you see, it's cheaper to use Mr. Glenn's ferry. Mr. Glenn, in the process, is the only guy there with a raft. Other people started doing that. Then you had Glenn's ferry, and then you had Joe's ferry, and Tom's ferry, and somebody else's ferry. And there were ferry services across the river. And then as time progressed along, he said, you know, it takes a long time to get across the river this way. Wouldn't it be kind of neat if we had a bridge across the river? And that bridge increases the productivity of everybody that uses it. It's not employment that we're looking for, kids. It's production. Hang on a second here, and let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-7000. 4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use in this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally approved by or supported by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you're hearing on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, or the sponsors, or management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about economics, and there's a neat book out here that I'm reviewing. It's called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. That's spelled H-A-Z-L-I-T-T. It's got a foreword in here by Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes, remember, was running for president back in 1992 and 1996 on the Republican ticket. He didn't get to first base. Even the Republicans rejected the free market. So if you think Republicans now have some market on, or some inroad on capitalism, you've made an error there. Republicans and Democrats are both socialists. You just have Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B. Both parties subscribe to paper money, stocks and bonds, negotiable instruments, usury and debt. Nobody's opposed to that, except those of us that believe in and practice free market economics. We're opposed to paper money, stocks and bonds, usury and debt. And then both of these parties over here will step forward, and they tell you very plainly they're all in favor of Social Security, labor unions, full employment, and they want to go out here and make jobs. They want the government to get involved in the economy and make things happen. Well, okay. That's the mistake. That's the fallacy. You see, the free market system isn't really a system. It's called that, but it's not. The free market system is a law unto itself. There's no system involved. There's nothing that you have to do. Nothing. You don't have to get out of bed. You don't have to go vote. You don't have to go to school and learn a lot of stuff. You just leave it alone. And it works perfectly. You know, we don't do anything to make the sun rise or the sun set, do we? You just leave it alone and it'll just work like a shot. Kind of reminds me one time when I was a little kid, I went down to a pond and I saw a phenomenon there. I saw gobs and gobs of gelatin-like mass with little dots in it. And I didn't know what it was, so I picked up a bunch of it. Took it home, and my granny said, well, those are frogs' eggs. So I put them in a jar, and I left them in the jar, and some of them hatched, and some of them didn't. And then some of the little tadpoles over there, they just died a little at a time, you know, one here and one there. And pretty soon, when it was all said and done, all of them died. Now, I meant well. You see, I wanted to help those frogs. I like frogs. I like tadpoles. I like nature. And I was just trying to help. And I just wanted to help those frogs. I just wanted to help them little tadpoles. About 5 years old, you know. And then when I got all through, I killed them all. They're all dead. None of them survived. And so I was crying about that, and my granny said, you know, when you found those eggs out there in the pond, if you just leave them alone, don't feed them, don't mess with them, just leave them, they'll hatch automatically, and they'll all turn into tadpoles, and there'll be a few snakes come along and eat a few of the tadpoles, but when it's all said and done, they will multiply and reproduce, and they've been doing that for thousands of years, and everything will be fine. You don't have to do anything to help those frogs survive. What you need to do is to get the hell out of the way and leave them alone. And what government needs to do to help us with our economy is to get the hell out of the way and leave us alone. And nature will take its course. And when you get to the Snake River, you'll have a choice to make. You can pay Glenn a dollar, and he'll take you across the river, or you can make your own raft and take yourself across free. If you think you can build yourself a raft and take yourself across the river free cheaper than paying him a buck, get after it. That's what the free market system's all about. It's about leave it alone. Don't mess with it. It works perfectly all by itself. It's already pre-programmed. Now, wages and employment are discussed as if they had no relation to production or productivity and output. It's on the assumption that there is only a fixed amount of work to be done, and the conclusion is drawn that a 30-hour week will provide more jobs than will therefore be preferable to a 40-hour week. So 100 make-work practices of labor unions are confused and tolerated. When a Petrillo threatens to put a radio station out of business unless it employs twice as many musicians as it needs, he is supported by part of the public because he is, after all, merely trying to create jobs. Now, when we had our WPA back in the 1930s, it was considered a mark of genius for the administrators to think of projects that would employ the largest number of men in relation to the value of the work performed. In other words, in which labor was least efficient. So they came up with these WPA and CCC jobs. They were out digging holes and filling them up. And they employed millions of people. Ran up lots of debt and took a lot of tax money and paid these people. Now, for the parasites that were receiving these direct transfers of wealth, that is, you went out and you caught fish in the ocean, brought them in and sold them. And then the government came along and took 25% of your fish and paid these guys to dig holes and fill them up. That wasn't a benefit to you, and it wasn't a benefit to them either. Not over the long haul. Not over the long haul. Every government job that's created causes three lost jobs in the private sector. It takes three of us in the private sector to support one of those parasites digging holes and filling it back up again. So if you want to pay some guy to dig holes and fill them back up, that's fine. But I would prefer, if I had my druthers here, I would prefer that the guy go out and make refrigerators, washing machines, and carpet with his time. Instead of digging holes and filling them back up, go make refrigerators. Go out in the ocean and catch some fish. Go up in the woods and cut some trees. Go to work in the mill and produce some boards. Go do something that is constructive and productive. Go make some things that we want, need, and can use. I don't need a filled up hole. Let me put it to you this way. Let's suppose that out in the marketplace, the federal government says we got to put these people to work, and so they take them over to the Arlington National Cemetery, and they say, here's a shovel. I want you to dig a hole here. I want you to dig a hole 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet deep. And they dig the hole, 3 by 3 by 3, and they hire another guy to come in there and fill it up. Now, let's suppose that this guy can do this job in a half a day, and let's suppose that this other guy can fill it up in a half a day. We got 1 day's pay, and we're paying these guys $100 a day. So we got two guys working. They're going to cost $200 a day. Well, then, three of us have to go to work out here and produce fish, meat, milk, butter, and eggs, and do all the things that we need to do to feed everybody. Because, see, these guys digging the hole out here in the cemetery, they're not producing any meat, milk, butter, and eggs. But they've got to have meat, milk, butter, and eggs to live. So somebody has to produce that meat, milk, butter, and eggs, don't they? So they come along and they take some meat, milk, butter, and eggs from us and give it to those guys. This is called a direct transfer. And it produces nothing. It takes away from us. I mean, hell, we already had the meat, milk, butter, and eggs. Now we got to give it to these two guys to dig a hole and to fill it back up. Direct transfers takes three of us out here in the productive economy to support each one of those guys. It takes six of us out here to support those two guys doing that. This is what they're advocating today. It's a common fallacy, been going on for hundreds of years. It's been going on, it's going on, and it's going to continue to go on, and I'm not going to change it by telling you about it. But by telling you about it, you may be alerted to the fact that that's non-productive. And in the next election, when you hear some guy tell you that I'm for jobs, 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 that'll tell you don't vote for that guy. Because if he's telling you that he's for jobs, 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 well, then it's going to cost you some money to employ somebody in that job. Now, you wouldn't go out here and hire some guy to dig a hole and fill it back up. Now, would you? But now, you might hire that guy to go out here and catch you some fish or to bring you in some coconuts or to bring you in some pineapples, wouldn't you? And that's all I'm telling you. I'd like to pay that guy. I'm not opposed to the guy working, not opposed to the guy producing. I want him to work, I want him to produce, and I want him to produce something that I want, that I need, and that I can use. And a hole in a cemetery lot and filling it back up isn't one of those things that I want to buy. I don't want to buy an M60 tank. I don't want to buy an F-22 Raptor. Now, my government comes along and they say, yeah, that's what you want to buy, Gordon. You want to buy tanks, and it's great for the guys that are making the airplanes and the tanks. It's great for those make-work projects. But keep in mind that when the government's spending $600 billion a year, that $600 billion that's coming out of your pocket and going into somebody else's pocket. And then as a result of that, it's a net loss to you, and it doesn't make any further productive gain other than the transfer. Now, the minute that a farmer produces a dollar, it translates into $7 worth of production. And when a miner, a fisherman, or a forestry man produces a dollar, it translates into five additional dollars. It multiplies itself. That is the creation of real wealth. That's what productivity is all about. When a fisherman goes out and catches 100 fish and brings them in and distributes those, sells those to us, he's being productive. He has created 100 fish worth of brand new production that never existed before. When a logger goes up and cuts down a tree and brings it into the mill, he has now created real wealth. All of us need boards. Secretaries working for insurance companies shuffling papers and sticking them into file cabinets produce nothing, and they still have to eat. Every one of those secretaries has to eat. Every one of those secretaries has to have a house. They all have to have a car, and they all have to have gasoline. And they're all busily consuming all of those consumer items, but they're producing nothing in return. Now, it would be far better if it were the choice, which it isn't, but it would be better to have maximum production with part of the population supported in idleness by undisguised relief than to provide full employment by so many forms of disguised make-work that production is disorganized. The progress of civilization has meant the reduction of employment, not its increase. The progress, ladies and gentlemen, that we have made over the last 100 years, from my granddad carrying a railroad tie on his shoulder a quarter of a mile out and dropping it on a ship, has been replaced by forklifts and carriers and huge cranes. And it has made the burden, the drudgery of work, better. We don't have to work as hard, and we can produce more. We can put more railroad ties into the hold of that ship today with less manpower than we ever did 100 years ago. That's progress. When you're washing your dishes, ladies, and I can remember my granny. I used to wash dishes here a time or two myself, but I can remember my granny right after dinner. She'd go in there and go wash the dishes. She never came in, sat down, listened to the radio until she had the dishes done. So she'd cook dinner from 5 to 6, and then she'd clean up and wash the dishes from 6 to 7. So she put in 2 hours of labor. Today, you know, you open up a TV dinner, you stick it in the microwave, you cook it up, and you stick the 3 or 4 knives and forks and spoons into the dishwasher, and hell, you're in the living room watching TV with the rest of us, aren't you? No, it's because we have become increasingly wealthy as a nation that we've been able virtually to eliminate child labor, to remove the necessity of work for many of the aged, and to make it totally unnecessary for millions of women to take jobs. A much smaller proportion of the American population needs to work than that, say, of China or Russia. And the real question is not how many millions of jobs there will be in America 10 years from now, but how much will we be producing 10 years from now? And what, in consequence, will be our standard of living? The problem of distribution on which all the stress is being put today is, after all, more easily solved the more there is to distribute. We can clarify our thinking if we put our chief emphasis where it belongs, on policies that will maximize production. Now let's take it down to a lower level, just you and me out here, and let's go plant a little garden, and let's put in 10 tomato plants. Our 10 tomato plants produce, let's say, 20 pounds of tomatoes each. That's 200 pounds of tomatoes. Now, our 200 pounds of tomatoes, let's say they're worth $1 a pound, they're worth $200 in the season to us, and so that's $200 worth of tomatoes that we didn't have to buy from the store. Now, let's suppose that we spend $1 a day on tomatoes. That's $365 a year. And we're producing 200 pounds of tomatoes, but we're short 165 pounds, and we have to pay $1 a pound for 165 pounds of tomatoes. So it costs us $165 a year. We produce 200 ourselves, and we buy 165 pounds. So that means we have to go out and work at something, whatever it is that you do in life, and you work. You have to take $165 and buy tomatoes to feed your family. Now, somebody comes along and says, why don't you plant 20 tomato plants next year, produce 400 pounds of tomatoes, and why don't you can a bunch of those tomatoes or dry them so that you don't have to buy any tomatoes? So now you've got consumer A, he produces no tomatoes, and he spends $365 a year on tomatoes to feed his family. Then we've got you, B, and you're producing 200 pounds, so you only have to spend $165. And then we've got C, that's me, and I'm producing 400 pounds, and I don't have to buy any tomatoes at all. I'm 100% self-sufficient in tomatoes. Can you see the benefit of working in your garden and producing the 200 or 400 pounds of tomatoes? Can you see the benefit of producing any tomatoes at all in lieu of buying all of your tomatoes? That's what productivity is all about. Now let's suppose that it's taking me to produce my 400 pounds of tomatoes. It takes me 400 man hours. 400 man hours. and they're worth a dollar a pound, so I'm getting paid $1 an hour for my labor producing tomatoes. Now, let's suppose that you're a mechanic and you're working down here at Mr. Goodwrench's shop, and you're getting $10 an hour as a mechanic, and you're getting $1 an hour for the 400 hours a year that you're working on your tomatoes. Has it occurred to you to give up spending 400 of your man hours growing tomatoes? Have you thought about maybe opening your garage up and doing some work on the side for your neighbors? You know, your neighbor over here, when he takes his car down to the garage, he has to pay $25 an hour. That's what it costs me when I go over to Mike, and Mike charges me $25 an hour. Well, if I had you, my neighbor, and you're a Mr. Goodwrench, and you're getting paid $10 an hour working for Mike, and you would fix my car here in your garage for $10 an hour, and you spent 400 hours a year working on automobiles, you'd get $4,000 worth of sales fixing cars. Then you could go out and buy 400 pounds of tomatoes at $1 a pound, and you'd still have $3,600 left over. Can you see how economics works right down here at the family level? That's what the marketplace is all about. It's free choice. It's your choice. Let me show you a little example of that. Over in Russia, they collectivized all the farms back in the 1930s. Joe Stalin got in there and said, we're gonna industrialize all the farms in Russia. We're going to take all the farmland in Russia, and we're going to take it over, and we're going to run it. The government's going to run it, and we'll have tractors, and we'll industrialize it just like we do steel mills. And their farm production fell off, and it was so bad, those people were hungry. So about during the World War II, they came up and said, we need more food. So they said, here's what we'll do. We will give all of you farm workers. You used to be farm owners, but now you're farm workers. We will give you a half an acre each. And you can grow anything on that half acre that you want to. And you can sell it to anybody you want to for whatever you can get. So they took that one segment of the economy and they created a free enterprise zone on that one half acre for all the workers in Russia. And guess what happened? They produced on the one half acres, that is several million people with a half an acre, produced as much food in Russia as all of the state farms in the country combined. Got that? Now, if you wanted to double the production in the Soviet Union, what should you do? You can't double the amount of land that the government owns and is already farming. But you could easily double from a half an acre to 1 acre the amount of land that the peasants hold. And if they're already producing as much as the entire nation of state-owned farms on a half an acre, if you gave them twice as much land, they'd produce twice as much, wouldn't they? Again, boys and girls, that's the miracle of the free enterprise system. And everywhere it's been used in the past, it has worked with dramatic results. It's never failed. And wherever socialism has been tried, such as the collective farms of the Soviet Union, it has always failed. Every single time in the past, and it's a failure today, and it will continue to be a failure in the future. So make your choice. You want to practice free market economics or socialism? Choice is yours. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.